With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details. Because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose, by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
You're listening to continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
The last point here, Judge, is that was also an express undertaking case, Judge. The reason why the court said, hey, yeah, we're going to remand with instructions, you can proceed with an assumed duty theory here, is because there is evidence, and the plaintiff there argued, they argued that, quote, Burns assumed a duty to investigate the report of a potential fight on school grounds and notify school security about the fight under the principle of assumption of a duty because Burns told Diaz that he would, quote, alert security, end quote, and, quote, look into it, end quote, and finally take care of it. Those are express promises and assurances to do something. That's, in Burns, they applied that doctrine, which is what the defense has been advocating for throughout. The court should preclude the plaintiff from now shifting the goalposts, changing their legal theory, especially now that we're at trial, when throughout they have maintained this is an express undertaking case. We're relying on Burns. In court now, and yesterday, they said we're still relying on Burns, but guess what? This is not a third-party criminal harm case. That raises due process problems, Judge. It's an appropriate-reprobate problem. It's just a fundamental fairness problem. And it's also just inconsistent with Burns. Burns was a third-party harm case, too.
Thank you. Your response?
Your Honor, if I'm counting correctly, this is the sixth time we have argued this. We argued at the demurrer stage, they lost. We argued at the summary judgment stage, they lost. Argued at the motion for directed verdict, lost. End of the case, summary judgment, lost. Jury instructions arguments last week, they lost. This is a notice pleading state. The court has addressed every one of these issues, and I believe Burns probably a dozen times. And I think that the court should not revisit the rulings that have been proper from the beginning until yesterday.
I decline the offer to reconsider my previous decisions. All right. Very well. Anything else to take up?
All right. An animation that we intended to use in closing argument that we've shared with opposing counsel as a courtesy to make sure that there wouldn't be objection. And they've objected to it, so I'd like to show it to Your Honor so that we could have a ruling.
And Your Honor, with the court's permission, can we view that video if we're going to show it either in chambers or only display it on counsel's displays? I think that would be appropriate given the nature of the content.
It's an animation of someone being shot. That's this case.
Say that again?
It's an animation of a bullet in showing the injuries of our client, which is the exact evidence of this case.
But it's an animation, right?
Correct.
Okay. I mean, you could just put it up on the small screens. But let me get organized. There was I wrote on the original verdict form plaintiff offered. Do you have another copy of that?
Yeah.
All right. Because that was not offered as part of this newest set, correct? Once again, I know that's objected to for the reasons previously stated.
Understood.
All right. And how long, switch chairs on me, Mr. Hogan, how long to get that revised jury instruction that I agreed to?
It's progress right now, Judge.
Okay, great. All right. Now we're moving on to the issue of a proposed animation drafted for purposes of argument. You, defense has seen that and is objecting, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right, very well. Up there.
I'll turn the screen if you want me to.
I mean, if I can, how long is it?
30 seconds.
A minute 30. Okay.
I can give you my iPad and show it to you.
I can watch it on that. Is there any objection to me watching it sideways?
No, Your Honor. Okay.
And your objection?
Your
Your Honor, a big issue with this animation is that it assumes facts that are not in evidence. The animation shows the plaintiff in a defensive posture. There wasn't any testimony to show that she was in a defensive posture when the bullet struck her. I think that fact alone goes to foreseeability, but also inferences can be made on a contributory negligence. The size of the bullet fragments may mislead the jury. In addition, the animation fails 2-4-3 balancing for the same reasons. The animation shows plaintiff in a defensive posture. The size of the bullet fragments may mislead the jury. The amount of blood entering the lungs, I don't think that that was in evidence either. The evidence is needlessly cumulative. They've already shown demonstrative exhibits throughout the trial. And a lot of this, we haven't really, there hasn't been any pushback from defense counsel. We're not disputing that she was shot. We're not disputing that she suffered broken bones. We're not disputing any of that. So, I would just point out that it's needlessly cumulative. The prejudicial effect also substantially outweighs any probative value under 2403. I think the clear intent of this is to have, or the effect of this is to have an image in the jurors' minds of the plaintiff sort of cowering in fear and being shot right before they go into deliberations. The prejudicial effect of that clearly outweighs its probative value, number one, because the sort of defensive posture is not in evidence. Second, it's going to invite the jurors to decide the case on improper grounds like bias or sympathy. Those are not proper grounds to decide the case. And I have some screenshots of the defensive posture if the court would like me to hand them up.
What do you mean? From what I just saw?
Yes.
I actually didn't see what you're showing me. There was no background to it.
I think the video that we were shown yesterday was slightly different.
Okay, yeah, because it's not that. I mean, I saw what I saw. All right, so anything else? Sorry, cut you off. All right. What I do want to hear from you on is overruled every other issue except that there's no evidence of her defensive posture, because I don't remember her testifying or anyone else testifying as to either the angle of the bullet or where her hand was when she was shot.
My recollection of her testimony is that she had put her hand up at the time the bullet came through, and then ultimately there was still evidence about the entry and exit wound, which that animation tracks accurately from Dr. Munn, and it was Dr. Anderson who talked about it going through the wrist. It was Dr. Munn who then talked about it in the lung, in this sort of capacity of how it filled up the chamber of the lung with blood and all of those.
Yeah, no, I don't have any problem with that.
This is from page 90 of the draft transcript that's been provided by Mr. Williamson. And is that why you lifted your hand? Did you know what was about to happen? Yes, yep.
My concern is with the trajectory of the bullet. We didn't hear any evidence of that, and that's clearly indicating a trajectory.
We could cut it to where it is going into her hand. In other words, we can start the video with the bullet entering into her hand instead of having to show her hand up and the bullet coming towards her.
Now, let me see just the beginning part again.
There.
Right, so you would just have it entering the hand?
Correct.
And the entrance wounds and exit wounds to both were testified to.
Correct.
Is that your position? And there was no evidence of her, where her right hand was. So here's, once again, I know you're objecting to all of it, but I'm going to allow you to play it from when the bullet hits the hand and then goes into her chest, but I want cut all of the parts where her whole breast of her is shown.
When it draws back and does her hand.
Exactly. And if we do that, then I grant that motion to those parts, deny on the other reasons. All right. Anything else you want to say?
Your Honor, I think had plaintiff's counsel represented that an expert had sort of testified to the accuracy of this? Is that what I heard?
I mean, the facts and evidence demonstrate what they're showing. So I don't have a problem with that. All right, so what I would ask then is, I know you probably need a few minutes to take care of that, which is fine, and then to show it to me with defense counsel and chambers before, just make sure we're all on the same page, and then we'll roll into instructions and closings.
Yes, Judge.
Okay. All right. Is our jury here? You're working
they
on it?
Should be.
Okay. You haven't heard yet?
I haven't heard.
Okay. So I will go back, and you're going to get me the copy. Oh, you have it? Fantastic. Hand that up for me. And are my instructions clear on that editing? My instructions clear on that? Okay, good.
Yes, Your Honor, could you please double check to confirm it's consistent with the note?
Yes.
I thought there was just a syntax issue that we adjusted.
Do you have my little sticky note?
Yes, Your Honor.
High level technology here. Can you print me a copy without the rule notice on the bottom? Do you have a clean? Do you have a clean copy without the rule on the bottom?
Yes, very
good. All right, great. Okay, that's inappropriate. I know you're objecting to it, but that's an appropriate statement of the law. Is that
we
correct?
Object to it, yes.
Okay. All right, you're going to get me a clean copy. So then we will call the jury in. I will read the instructions as numbered, and I'll add that in. And then we will go into closing arguments. Madam Clerk will then choose, she will have cut the nine names, the slips. They're in this little jar. And our court reporter will pick two names out of there, and then they will be read into the record, and they will be released, and then the jury will deliberate. All right. Any questions about the process, plaintiff, defense? All right. Very well. Being a brief recess.
You may be seated.
All right. Anything to take up before we read the jury the instructions? Plaintiff? Defense? All right. Bring in the jury.
Please stand for the jurors.
Nine jurors in the box.
Request a poll.
All right, poll wave. All right, good morning still, ladies and gentlemen. All right, thank you all for coming back. Parties in the court have been working and worked both on Monday afternoon and this morning to get to the place where we are today. So what our business for today is I will read you the jury instructions. These are your instructions of law in accordance with all the other things that I've instructed you both on the first day and in between. You will be taking a copy of this back with you, so you do not have to take notes on these. They will all go back with you, and you'll be able to spend as much time as you want looking them over and discussing them. After that, you are going to hear closing statements and arguments from both sides in the case, and then we will turn the matter over to you for your decision. Jury instruction number one. Your verdict must be based on the facts as you find them and on the law contained in all of these instructions. The issues in this case are: one, was defendant Ebony Parker grossly negligent? Two, was defendant Ebony Parker's gross negligence a proximate cause of Abigail Zwirner's damages? On these issues, the plaintiff has the burden of proof. Number three, was plaintiff Abigail Zwirner contributorily negligent? Four, was plaintiff Abigail Zwirner's contributory negligence a proximate cause of her damages? On these issues, the defendant has the burden of proof. Five, if plaintiff Abigail Zwirner is entitled to recover, what is the amount of her damages? On this issue, the plaintiff has the burden of proof. Your decision on these issues must be governed by the instructions that follow. In the instructions that follow, where you see reference to the plaintiff, this is in reference to plaintiff Abigail Zwirner. And where you see the reference to the defendant, this is in reference to defendant Ebony Parker. Instruction number two. You are the judges of the facts, the credibility of the witnesses, and the weight of the evidence. You may consider the appearance and manner of the witnesses on the stand, their intelligence, their opportunity for knowing the truth and for having observed the things about which they testified, their interest in the outcome of the case, their bias, and if any have been shown, their prior inconsistent statements, or whether they have knowingly testified untruthfully as to any material fact in the case. You may not arbitrarily disregard believable testimony of a witness. However, after you have considered all the evidence in the case, then you may accept or discard all or part of the testimony of a witness as you think is proper. You are entitled to use your common sense in judging any testimony. From these things and all the other circumstances in the case, you may decide which witnesses are more believable and weigh their testimony accordingly. Any fact that may be proved by direct evidence may also be proved by circumstantial evidence. That is, you may draw all reasonable conclusions from the evidence. Instruction 4. If you believe from the evidence that a witness other than a party previously made a statement inconsistent with his or her testimony at this trial, the only purpose for which you may consider the statement is for its bearing on the witness's credibility. It is not evidence that what the witness previously said is true. Instruction 5. If you believe from the evidence that a party previously made a statement inconsistent with his or her testimony at this trial, you may consider that previous statement as evidence of what the party previously said was true. Instruction 6. In considering the weight to be given the testimony of an expert witness, you should consider the basis for their opinion and the manner by which they arrived at it and the underlying facts and data upon which they relied. Instruction 7. You have heard evidence about written policies or procedures. These policies or procedures do not set the legal standard of the case. Compliance with or violation of such rules does not, by itself, prove or disprove whether any party was negligent or grossly negligent, and you must not consider this evidence for that purpose. The applicable duties and standards of care are defined in these instructions. Instruction 7.5. Plaintiff answered requests for admissions. Any manner admitted in request for admissions is conclusively established. Instruction 8. You must not consider any matter that was rejected or stricken by the court. It is not evidence and should be disregarded. Instruction 9. Any amount of damages requested is not evidence in the case. You should not consider it as evidence in reaching your verdict. Instruction 10. You must not base your verdict in any way upon sympathy, bias, guesswork, or speculation. Your verdict must be based solely on the evidence and the instructions of the court. Instruction 11. The greater weight of all the evidence is also called the preponderance of the evidence. It is that evidence which you find more persuasive when evaluated against all of the evidence that has been admitted in the case. The testimony of one witness whom you believe can be the greater weight of the evidence. Instruction 12. Negligence is the failure to use ordinary care. Ordinary care is the care a reasonable person would have used under the circumstances of this case. Instruction 13. Gross negligence is that degree of negligence which shows such indifference to others as constitutes an utter disregard of caution, amounting to a complete neglect of the safety of another person. It is such negligence as would shock fair-minded people, although it is something less than willful recklessness. Instruction 14. The degree of negligence that the plaintiff must prove by a preponderance of the evidence in this case is gross negligence, as that term is defined in the other instructions provided. Instruction 15. Several acts of negligence which separately may not amount to gross negligence, when combined, may have a cumulative effect showing a form of reckless or total disregard for another's safety. If you find the defendant committed more than one act or omission of negligence, you may find the cumulative effect of those acts or omissions equates to gross negligence. Instruction 16. A person who undertakes gratuitously or for consideration to render services to another which she should recognize as necessary for the protection of a third person is subject to liability to the third person for physical harm resulting from her failure to exercise reasonable care to protect her undertaking if A. Her failure to exercise reasonable care increases the risk of such harm, or B. The harm is suffered because of reliance of the other or the third person upon the undertaking. If you find the defendant assumed a duty of care and, with gross negligence, breached that duty of care, proximately causing plaintiff's damages, then you shall find for the plaintiff, unless you find plaintiff was contributory negligent, and plaintiff's contributory negligence is a proximate cause of her damages. Instruction 17. The defendant is not required to have anticipated or foreseen the precise injury or damages that occurred, but it is sufficient that a reasonably prudent person would have anticipated or foreseen that some injury or damages might probably result from the negligent act. Instruction 18. The plaintiff has the burden of proving by the greater weight of the evidence that the defendant was grossly negligent and that the defendant's gross negligence was a proximate cause of injuries to the plaintiff. Instruction 19. A proximate cause of an injury is a cause that, in the natural and continuous sequence, produces the injury. It is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. Instruction 20. The fact that the plaintiff was injured does not, of itself, entitle her to recover. Instruction 21. When a defendant claims contributory negligence as a defense, she has the burden of proving by the greater weight of the evidence that the plaintiff was negligent and that this negligence was a proximate cause of the plaintiff's injuries. Contributory negligence may be shown by the defendant's evidence or by the plaintiff's evidence. Instruction 22. Contributory negligence is the failure to act as a reasonable person would have acted for her own safety under the circumstances of this case. Instruction 23. A plaintiff has a right to assume that the defendant will exercise ordinary care until she realizes, or in the exercise of ordinary care should realize, that the defendant is not going to do so. Instruction 24. If you find from the greater weight of the evidence that both plaintiff and defendant were negligent, and that their negligence proximately contributed to the incident, you may not compare negligence of the parties. Any negligence of the plaintiff, which was a proximate cause of the incident, will bar her from recovering. Instruction 25. You shall find your verdict for the plaintiff if she has proved by the greater weight of the evidence that 1. Defendant was grossly negligent, and that 2. Defendant's gross negligence was a proximate cause of the plaintiff's injury and damages. You shall find your verdict for the defendant if 1. The plaintiff failed to prove either or both of the elements above, or if 2. You find by the greater weight of the evidence that the plaintiff was contributory negligent and that the plaintiff's contributory negligence was a proximate cause of her injury and damages. Instruction 26. If you find your verdict for the plaintiff, then in determining the damages to which she is entitled, you shall consider any of the following which you believe by the greater weight of the evidence was caused by the gross negligence of the defendant. 1. Any bodily injuries she sustained and their effect on her health according to their degree and probable duration. 2. Any physical pain and mental anguish she has suffered in the past and any that she may be reasonably expected to suffer in the future. 3. Any disfigurement or deformity or any associated humiliation or embarrassment she suffered in the past and any she may be reasonably expected to suffer in the future. And 4. Any inconvenience caused in the past and any that probably will be caused in the future. Your verdict shall be for such sum as will fully and fairly compensate the plaintiff for the damages sustained as a result of the defendant's gross negligence. Instruction 27. The burden is on the plaintiff to prove by the greater weight of the evidence each item of damage she claims and to prove that each item was caused by the defendant's gross negligence. She is not required to prove the exact amount of her damages, but she must show sufficient facts and circumstances to permit you to make a reasonable estimate of each item. If plaintiff fails to do so, then she cannot recover for that item. Instruction 28. If you find that the plaintiff had a condition before the incident that was aggravated as a result of the incident, or that pre-existing condition made the injury she received in the incident more severe or more difficult to treat, then if you find your verdict for the plaintiff, she may recover for the aggravation and for the increased severity or difficulty of treatment, but she is not entitled to recover for the pre-existing condition. Instruction 29. The plaintiff has a duty to minimize her damages. If you find that the plaintiff did not act reasonably to minimize her damages and that as a result they increased, then she cannot recover for the amount by which they increased. 30. Plaintiff's projected life expectancy pursuant to Virginia law is an additional 53 years. You should consider this along with any other evidence relating to the health, constitution, and habits of the plaintiff in determining her life expectancy. Finally, you will be sent back with your verdict form. The verdict form has the names of the parties, the case number, and then right under it, two options. Option one says, we, the jury, on the issues joined, find in favor of plaintiff Abigail Zwirner and assess her damages at, there's a blank with a dollar sign, and award interest beginning on blank date. That date could be from the date of judgment or the date of the injury. Or any other date that you deem appropriate. Or the second line says, we the jury on the issues joined find in favor of defendant Ebony Parker and against plaintiff Abigail Zwirner, and at the bottom is a signature for your jury person. So when you go back, after you have made your decision unanimously, you're gonna check a box, put an X on the top line or the bottom line. If you put a X on the top line, you will fill in the amount of the award and then any interest, the date that interest runs from, or an X on the line next to line two, and your jury person needs to sign by both name and number. Mr. Beniazin, are you prepared with your closing statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
May it please the court.
You may proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning. A gun changes everything. At least it should. And on January 6th, 2023, a gun walked on the campus of Richneck Elementary School. That gun changed the thoughts of every student who saw it, heard about it, staff member.
Your Honor, objection. It's not about the students.
Over. You may proceed.
It changed what they did, where they went, and it changed one young woman's life forever. Except it didn't change the actions of one person. It didn't change where Dr. Parker went. It didn't change what she did. And those choices that she made to treat January 6, 2023, like any other day, even though a gun should change everything, is why we're here today. We're here today to ask you to do something that we can't do alone. And the thing that we cannot do alone is that we cannot achieve accountability by ourselves. That's what jurors are for. That's what you all are here to do if you find that accountability should be had. And you all may have different jobs when you walk outside of this courtroom. You may have different obligations in your personal life. But when you're in this courtroom and you walk back to that deliberation room, if you're one of the jurors that decides this case, your job is to deliberate together and return a unanimous verdict. And in doing that, one of the first things you all will do, if the judge hasn't already told you, is you're going to pick a foreperson. And that foreperson's responsibility is to make sure that everyone participates in the verdict, that everybody's voice is heard in that room, that everybody chimes in and shares their ideas and talks about the evidence. And the reason for that is that the nine of you who are here and the seven of you who will decide this case are here as representatives of this community to voice their conscience of what's right. Just like yesterday was election day and we all cast our ballots, you all are here individually, but as part of this community to decide what should have happened on January 6, 2023. And when you're in that room and you're deciding these issues, there may be times where you disagree. And the hard part of this is you've been here for a week and a half and you get to know each other, and sometimes we can hear you laughing as you come out, which is great. And you've made friends. But when you get back into that jury deliberation room and you're talking about the issues in this case, and you're talking about how to decide something, you're going to have to speak and share your thoughts. And we're asking you to fight. We're asking you, when you get back there, to fight for what you believe is the right outcome in this case. And when you're doing that, one of the instructions that I will point you to, and the judge talked about it and I talked about it earlier when we picked the jury, is the burden of proof. We talked in voir dire, if you remember, we said this isn't a criminal case where you decide things beyond a reasonable doubt, and I may have done this with my hands depending on which group you were in. I say this is a case you decide on the preponderance of the evidence. And I show you this because when you get into that deliberation room and you're fighting about issues or you're trying to decide something, and look, I hope you get back there and everybody takes a straw poll and says, you're with us. I hope it. And we've put on enough evidence, I think, that that may be true. But as you're deciding those issues, this is where you come to. This question of what's more likely true than not true. That's the burden of proof in this case. And so with that, I'm going to take a step back and I'm going to give you a roadmap for what we'll talk about. This is called summation. It's my chance to tell you all what I think the evidence was. But you all were paying attention. You all took copious notes. And candidly, if the judge lets you, I'm sure you could come up here and give closing arguments yourself and tell us what this case was about. I think you know it that well. So my goal here isn't just to tell you what you heard from that witness stand or what you saw on that TV. My job here is to try and talk ideas so that when you get into that room and you're having those discussions, you have an idea of, okay, how do we resolve this? What are tactics that we can think through and process, and how do we answer these questions? And some you may like, and some you may not, and that's okay. That's my job so that I can help you do your job in that room in however long it takes us to get there. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna move pretty quick. We've already talked about your job. I'm gonna move quick through the second stop, which is what I'll call fault, and we're gonna focus on what Dr. Parker's job was. Then I'm gonna talk about the blame game. And then if you'll let me, I'm gonna slow down and I'll talk about costs and consequences at the end. And the reason I slow down is that it sounds like we're gonna go fast, and we're gonna try and go fast for the first part, but I don't wanna lose grasp of what we're really here for. And that's to talk about the effect that this has had on Ms. Swarm. Sound good? All right, we can go to the PowerPoint. So, your roadmap, fault, blame, and costs. Fault. Her job is safety. Dr. Parker's job is safety. We talked in opening statement about promises. Do you remember that when Ms. Toscano came up here and we talked about expressed and implied promises, the things we say and the things that are meant with what we say? And when we get out onto the road, I know a lot of us don't have keys with keys anymore, but there's still keys out there. I'm a 4Runner. You put that key in the ignition, you turn, and as you go out onto the roadway, you're making a promise. You don't have to say it to people, but what you're saying is, by strapping your seatbelt and going out onto the highway, you're saying, I promise to look out for you. I promise to see the stop signs that are there to be seen. I promise to stop at those stop signs. I promise to turn my blinker on when I go to change lanes. I make these promises because you rely on me to make the promise, and I rely on you to make the promise so each of us can go home at night and see our families. We make those promises even though we never say them out loud. And then there are promises that come with what we say or how we say them. There are promises when you answer the phone and agree to take action or to find something out. And then the question becomes, what happens when you put the phone receiver down on the table and you don't meet that promise? That is what the judge was talking about when he instructed you on what's called instruction 16. And this is the law to govern you in this case. It says, a person who undertakes gratuitously or for consideration, in other words, whether you're paid for it or not, to render services which she should recognize as necessary for the protection of the third person, is subject to liability, we're talking about fault, to the third person, in this case, we're talking about Ms. Warner, for the physical harm resulting from her, Dr. Parker, failure to exercise care to protect her undertaking. So what does that mean? And we'll get through some of this evidence in a moment. But whether it was on a phone or through a doorway, around noon on January 6, 2023, there was a communication. And that communication involved a gun and a backpack. And she answered the call. And the question that you have to decide now is, by answering that call, by making the promise that I'm going to find something out, explicitly or implicit, when we talk about other promises later, did her failure to exercise reasonable care, in this case, did her failure to act, to do something, increase the risk of harm to Ms. Werner? Or, it's an or question, not an and, did Ms. Werner suffer harm because she relied on the third person, that is, she relied on somebody to act? That's our framework, right? That's what we're talking about in this case. That's the law that governs your decision. And let's talk about facts as they come through them. You're gonna hear, before I do that, I have to explain this thing of negligence that we talked about. We've heard this word negligence. You've heard the judge talk about gross negligence. We'll look at the instruction a little bit later. Best way I know how to explain it, okay? Hang with me. If I had a baseball and I turned around, sorry, Keith, Mr. Williamson, if I turned around and I thought, I'm gonna try and hit that gavel off the top. Actually, I'm gonna change my mind. I'm just gonna point right at Mr. Williamson's forehead. And I threw that ball, meaning to hit his forehead. That's what we call an intentional harm, right? You get it? I meant to do it, and I did it if I threw the ball. Negligence is knowing I'm not as good a baseball player as probably the judge. If I looked up at that gavel and said, or maybe that apple, said, I can probably hit that. And I threw it and I hit Mr. Williamson. I didn't mean to do it. I didn't intend to hit him. But it was not the wisest choice. Opposing counsel said at one point in opening statement, it was inadequacy. Remember that line? It's not indifference, it's inadequacy. We'll come back to that. It's not quite what I should do. Gross negligence. If I turn around, sorry y'all, and I decide I'm gonna try and throw the ball to Mr. Bright. And in between Mr. Bright are Ms. Werner and Ms. Toscano. The risk of danger has gone up, right? It's gonna be harder for me to throw that ball. And the truth is, I ain't that good at baseball. And so there's just as good of a chance that I throw it at him or I hit one of these two. That means I'm kind of indifferent. I may get it done, I may not. That's what we call gross negligence. The risk of harm has increased, and I'm somewhat indifferent to the outcome. And then we talk about recklessness, which is in one of the instructions. Recklessness is saying, I'm gonna try and hit that back wall through that crowd of people, and by golly, I hope I do it, knowing the likely outcome. So we have levels to this, if you want to think of it that way. And the question is, how great is the danger? How great is the harm, the risk of it? And when I act or fail to act, how likely is it that something's going to happen? So, we've seen a lot of faces. We've heard a lot of testimony. Told you I'm not going to go through everything, but let's go through this. I told you at noon or around noon that day, there was Ms. Kovac was told that by two girls that there was a gun. What we know is that Ms. Kovac shared that information with Dr. Parker. And what I'm going to come back to throughout this closing argument, throughout this summation, is that every minute matters. Every minute matters. Ms. Kovac says, we think the gun's in the backpack. And according to our expert, Ms. Shufflebarger, as you remember, at that moment, a gun changes everything. A gun changes everything. You stop and you investigate. You get to the bottom of it. You get to the bottom of that backpack. You get to the bottom of his pockets. Whatever it is, you get to the bottom of it to know whether that gun is real and on campus so you can deal with it. But that's not what happened. So later a communication comes back, we think it's put in the pocket. And then the check of the backpack happens, and it's gun out of backpack. And this is where we have the line, there are little pockets. It's a line that we heard on the stand. It's a line that you just can't forget when you hear those words. And then you have search the person, and the response is check the bag. And I want to stop here. By this point in the day, Miss West has asked Mr. Sims to ask Dr. Parker, have you searched the person? And when that communication is read or brought to Dr. Parker, what do we know? We heard in the instructions that evidence can be proven by direct and circumstantial evidence. What does that mean? I don't need to see the rain coming down from the sky to know it's raining if I walk out in the morning and there are puddles on the floor, right? I don't need to see the rain. I know it rained. And when Dr. Parker says, in response to, did you search the person? We checked the bag. What that tells us is that that was a real threat. That it was accepted as true, so much so that we needed to check the bag. All this talk about we didn't think it was a real threat. It wasn't a credible threat. Why are you agreeing with Ms. Kovac to search the bag if you don't think it's real? And when they say, did you search the person? And their response is, we already checked the bag. Guess what that tells us? We thought it was real. And we don't know where it is anymore. We don't know where it is anymore. And then the boy, outside of Miss West's classroom, crying, remember? Crying, not wanting to go back into Mrs. Z's classroom where he's supposed to be, says, bullets and shoot. The boy showed me bullets, JT showed me bullets, and he said if I told anybody, I would shoot. Bullets, shoot, gun. The only way you can shoot a bullet is if you have a gun. And to tell us that telling a boy that he will be shot is not a threat. Not a threat. Goes against the very language that 6-year-old used. And then he goes and has a conversation with her again.
More continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial is coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a moment. From the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.